You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Mark Glenn, radio host and author and the publisher of The Ugly Truth. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
It is my honor, Dave.
Mark, we've known each other for several years and we talk occasionally, mostly via Skype, and you said something very interesting a little bit ago about a war starting up between the United States and Russia. I want to get into that in great detail, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, just give them a little bit of background about who you are, what you've done, and what you do.
I at one time did write for American Free Press. I am the author of several books and many, many articles, all of them dealing with one singular issue, which is the situation in the Middle East, mainly American foreign policy. And for me, Dave, just like you, somebody who has roots in the Middle East, when this war began in 2003, but we really want to be honest about it, it began as far back as 1967 or 1948, I knew that we were in for big trouble because in the aftermath of 9/11, it was obvious that the players who were responsible for putting this thing together had big plans in mind. And being the father of many children, I did the math pretty quickly and surmised that unless something is done to bring a halt to this, that I'm going to wind up seeing my children being dragged off to fight and die for these wars that have only one beneficiary, and of course that is Israel. So my work is 100% devoted to that. I don't get into chemtrails. I don't get into Bigfoot. I don't get into UFOs. I tend to pattern my work after our very good friend and colleague, Michael Collins Piper, who also is very focused in his work and deals exclusively with one topic, which is Zionism, Jewish extremism, American foreign policy in the Middle East, and how this is all affecting us on a daily basis.
Okay, and I see you regularly on Press TV and other outlets, so you get around quite a bit in that circuit, don't you?
A bit. I do 3 interviews a week, generally with Press TV, and once in a while, I'm honored to give a speech somewhere. I was honored to speak at a gathering last September when the president of Iran was in New York addressing the UN General Assembly, and I was very, very honored to be one of the few speakers at that banquet in his honor, and just thinking about it now, kind of, it's an odd thing to do when you're standing 6 feet away from a man who, for the last 8 years, has been demonized by the Jewish mainstream media. And, you know, there are no horns coming out of his head. There are no fangs hanging out of his mouth. There's no fire coming out of his ears. He's just a very kind, soft-spoken man. And in some respects, I know this is probably going to be viewed as heretical by some people, but in some respects, he's given the same treatment as Jesus Christ was by his enemies. So I guess in that respect, I do get around, as you say, but I see it all as part of the greater good, Dave, as you do. I mean, you're spending this time here tonight carrying on this conversation, doing this interview when you could be spending time with your family or doing something else, but instead you have decided to dedicate your time here in these wee hours of the evening towards fighting the good fight, and that's what I'm doing as well.
Right, exactly. We need more people like you, Mark, that's for sure. This was very intriguing what you said, because you said it to me very matter-of-factly that I'm about to be dragged into a war. I don't know what kind of war you were alluding to, whether it was a regional war or a world war. So why don't you start from the beginning? What made you think that, and what makes you think that the United States and Russia are about to come to blows?
In order to paint this picture, we have to go back to 1967. Now, you doubtless heard me reference that year when you were introducing me to the program, and it's a very important year, Dave, and the listeners to this program, because in 1967, we literally came within 3 minutes of going to war with what was at that time the Soviet Union. What was taking place on June the 8th, 1967, was that the USS Liberty, a U.S. flagship, was being attacked by Israel for nearly 2 hours. It was basically a defenseless ship. It had no means of fighting back. It was deliberately sent into those waters and set up by certain elements working within the United States government and, of course, Israel itself, with the intent of sinking the ship and blaming this on Egypt. Now, the conventional understanding of those who have studied the Liberty attack has been that what Israel was trying to do that day was to sink the ship, blame it on Egypt, and drag the United States into Israel's wars for her that was taking place at this time. This was the Six-Day War in 1967. But that's only partly true. Yes, they were trying to sink the ship. Yes, they intended on blaming it on Egypt. And yes, they did want the United States to get involved in the region, but not necessarily to get involved with the war that was taking place at that moment, because the war was basically, for all intents and purposes, over at that point. Egypt had been defeated, and that was really the larger part of the war between Israel, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. what was at stake that day is that the sinking of the Liberty, while it would have been blamed on Egypt, was supposed to result in an American strike on Egypt using nuclear weapons. Now, at the time, Egypt was allied with the Soviet Union. In fact, Egypt was the Soviet Union's biggest client state in the Middle East. And both the Israelis and the Americans wanted the Russians out of the Middle East because all three of these countries that Israel was fighting at that time, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, were client states of the Soviet Union. And the Israelis and the Americans wanted them out of the region. So the plan was to sink the Liberty, blame it on Egypt, put the Soviet Union diplomatically and politically in such a difficult position that it would have no other option than to leave the region eventually, especially after the United States responded militarily to this, to leave the region and basically have the United States move into these countries politically, economically, militarily, as the United States has done vis-a-vis Egypt and Jordan. The only country that is left out of that trio right now is Syria, which, as those of you who have been following the news, can see that this is playing a very important role right now, particularly the fact that Russia is the only one that is standing in the way of Syria being turned into hamburger. Not that she hasn't been turned into hamburger already with nearly 3 years of this American and Israeli-backed civil war that is taking place. So, in effect, what happened that day when the Liberty was attacked and when the Liberty did not sink as planned, and those nuclear weapons that were on their way to Cairo, that were only 180 seconds away from being delivered. And we know that this is a fact. We have testimony from the American ambassador to Egypt, who has testified on videotape, that indeed he did get a call saying that the bombers are on their way. So this is not a theory that the United States was on its way to bomb Egypt for this. So in effect, what has taken place is because the Liberty did not go down, in effect, fate pressed the pause button on this drama. And now with what is taking place right now, somebody has pressed play again. And somebody is sitting there in the shadows, again, trying to engineer a war between what is today the United States and what was then the Soviet Union, but what is now Russia. You know, Dave, you and I were talking about this relative to the latest news involving Snowden and the story involving the NSA and how it's spying on Americans and listening to all of our phone calls and all of the rest of that. And this is part and parcel of this, because what is going on right now is that Israel is absolutely desperate to get a war going, primarily with Iran, but using as the back door to that a war with Syria. This civil war that has been going on, you know, that's just an extension of the quote-unquote Arab Spring, you know, they did not intend for this thing to be dragging on for almost 3 years, okay? You look at what happened in Tunisia and you look at what happened in Egypt, both of these, which were Zionist and American-engineered revolutions, cheaper to have the people themselves unseat these leaders rather than to have to put American boots on the ground the way that we did with Iraq. They were done deals in literally just a few weeks. Libya, of course, was a little bit tougher nut to crack. It did take NATO going in and bombing the hell out of that country and killing over 100,000 people. Syria was not supposed to have been as difficult as it is. And it's dragging on. And in the meantime, the Russians are digging themselves in deeper. The Iranians are digging themselves in deeper. And so this elusive goal, this elusive dream on the part of Israel of creating this Israeli empire that stretches from the Nile to the Euphrates rivers is becoming more and more distant. So they are absolutely desperate to get Obama committed militarily, and I mean overtly. The United States is in Syria. We have been funding this thing and training these rebels and arming them from the very beginning. So let's not have any illusions about that, okay? This is not a grassroots revolution. These are thugs. As a matter of fact, I just received word from a friend of mine this morning who has cousins in southern Lebanon who are in Hezbollah and who just returned from Syria after fighting. And they have made it clear, they said that these members of the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, that these guys are thugs from all over the Middle East. Most of them who have been killed have been found with drugs on their possession, with lots of American money. And so this thing is anything but a grassroots revolution. It is war by other means. But what Israel wants is to speed things along. They want what was done to Libya done to Syria, what was done to Iraq done to Syria. And Obama simply doesn't want to do it. His military men have told him, Mr. President, we can't do this. His intelligence community has told him, Mr. President, we cannot do this, especially now that the Russians have drawn a line in the sand. But this doesn't matter to Israel. Israel doesn't care what price America has to pay for this. So bringing this thing full circle, as our good friend Mike Piper likes to say, how does Israel achieve something like this, meaning overt war against Syria and Iran? How do they do this? Well, they achieve this through the typical tried and true methods of blackmail, which they have employed many times in the past. And that is where the Snowden scandal comes in. Now, as you and I were talking earlier today, Dave, one of the things that I pointed out, and which is getting really no play whatsoever in all of the millions of words that are being written and spoken about the Snowden affair, is that this is not news. The U.S. government listening in on people's private conversations. This is as old as literally 9/11. And more importantly, the Israeli angle to this. If people will bother to go to YouTube and do a search and just type in Fox News, Cameron Israeli spying, they will pull up several entries that have been archived of the four-part series that appeared on Fox News in November of 2001. So this is just 2 months after the September 11th attacks. And Fox News, even though it's not on their website anymore because Abe Foxman paid a personal visit to the executives at Fox News and told them to pull this off of their website, nevertheless, it's been archived on YouTube and it's all over the place. And in this news story, it was made clear through interviews that have been done with U.S. intelligence, both the NSA and the CIA, that Israel has been bugging the American phone system since before 9/11 through Israeli companies such as Verint, Naris, Amdocs, Converse Info Systems. All of these companies have been bugging the American telecommunications network now since before 9/11. But see, we're not getting any of that. We're not getting any of that in the coverage involving Snowden revealing that the NSA has been listening in on American phone calls. So what we see taking place here, this is Obama's Lewinsky moment, okay? If everybody will think back to the Clinton years, when Bill Clinton was cornered with the very embarrassing scandal involving him and this nice little Jewish girl named Monica Lewinsky, and the fact that he had lied in testimony about carrying on any kind of extramarital business with her, this was Benjamin Netanyahu's operation. This was his way of putting pressure on Bill Clinton to pick up where George Bush, the elder, had left off with regards to Iraq. Because remember, George Bush did not finish the job. Okay, Iraq was left as a barely functioning state, but nevertheless, it was not destroyed in the way that Benjamin Netanyahu and these other Likud-type gangsters had demanded. And George Bush, after liberating Kuwait and basically driving the Iraq army back to Baghdad, he said, that's it, no mas. I'm not going any further than this. And this infuriated Likud. So when George Bush was unseated from the presidency as a result of doing this, and his successor was brought in, namely William Jefferson Clinton, and Clinton decided that he was not going to pick up where George Bush had left off, this was the reason why pressure had been put on him vis-a-vis Monica Lewinsky. Well, this is what we are seeing now with Barack Obama. We have seen a series of what I characterize as escalating scandals. The first one involving Benghazi, the second one involving the U.S. Justice Department reading the emails of reporters working in the American mainstream media, the third one being the IRS scandal, and now the fourth one being Snowden. So as much as those of us who are jealous of our privacy and who have been saying for many years that, you know, the government is up to no good, as much as we want to champion this latest news involving Snowden at the same time, we have to remember, first of all, A, that this is not news. This is an old story. And B, incredible pressure is being put on Obama by the Jewish mainstream media, the same Jewish mainstream media that lied us into war with Iraq, the same Jewish mainstream media that wants to see us going to war against Syria and Iran, which could very easily lead to open hostilities with Russia.
Thank you for explaining that. How close do you think it is to this happening?
There are all sorts of variables. Nobody who was involved in the planning of the attack on the Liberty expected things to happen the way that they did. That ship should have gone down. According to the testimony that I have gotten from the people who were there that day, if that fifth torpedo that had struck the ship, if it had been just 12 inches to the left of the ship would have gone down. The fact is that where it hit, it struck a load-bearing beam that basically kept the water from pouring into the engineering room that would have hit the boiler and caused the ship literally to go up like an atomic bomb. So 12 inches is what saved the world that day. That was a miracle in and of itself, the fact that that torpedo was 12 inches off. So there are all sorts of variables here that make it impossible to predict with any kind of precision what is going to happen next. How close we are, there's no way to judge that. But the fact that, according to the sources that I have, that there are Iranians, Revolutionary Guard, on the ground in Syria, there are Russian special forces on the ground in Syria, means that this is not a Cold War. Okay, it's a hot war. And the Russians are serious about this. You know, when the Liberty was being attacked, the Russians had a submarine stationed off the coast of Haifa that day. And the submarine commander had orders that day to nuke Israel if the Liberty went down. So the Russians were well aware of what was going on, so much so that during the attack, it has been told to me by people who were in a position to know at the time that when the Liberty was being attacked, that the premier at that time called Johnson and he said, "We know what you're up to, and if you want a war, we will give you a war." So the Russians were serious then, and the Russians are serious now. They are not going to be driven out of their last place in the Middle East, the last base that they have on the Mediterranean Sea, which is in Tartus. And more important than that, the Russians understand that these wars that have been launched against countries such as Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya, Putin made a statement during his second term as president. He was addressing a group of cadets who had just graduated from one of the military academies there. And he said, "Iraq is the reason why Russia must remain a strong military power." Now, this is after Iraq had been destroyed. But the message that Putin was making was, here you have Iraq, a resource-rich country that has been destroyed by the United States working in collusion with Israel. Now, what was Putin saying at that time? He was saying, we're next. Okay, we are a resource-rich country. We refuse to play ball with these gangsters making up the crime cabal known as the New World Order. And we are going to fight them militarily if necessary. So the Russians understand they're not doing this because they like the Syrian people or they think that the food is great or that the women are beautiful. They're not doing this because they share similar feelings for the Iranians. They're doing this because they know that they're next, that if they do not stand up and assert themselves politically, economically, diplomatically, militarily, take your pick, that they are going to find themselves going the way of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, take your pick. So it is a particularly dangerous situation that we're in right now, Dave. I realize I've been going on for a bit here. I know that you'd like to give me a break and jump in here as well. And so I'll end this by saying this. It is a very dangerous situation that we're in right now. As I tell my listeners often these days in talking about these events that are taking place right now, it is June the 8th, 1967 right now. The USS Liberty is under attack, and there is no telling what is going to happen. Are we going to get a miracle the way that we did on the afternoon of June the 8th, 1967? I hope so, because now the stakes are much higher. We have an insane megalomaniac in control of 200 nuclear weapons, calling himself Benjamin Netanyahu, who abides by the doctrine that this experiment of Jewish self-rule in the Middle East, that if this fails, then the world has to pay for this by the world being consumed in nuclear fire. I use this description on my program a lot as well. Think back to the Star Trek movie, The Wrath of Khan, at the end of the movie. Khan has basically lost the battle, but his last act before dying is that he's going to detonate this doomsday weapon that's going to consume his enemies. All of his enemies. This is the Samson option. And this is basically what we're dealing with in the person of Benjamin Netanyahu and the people that he has surrounded himself with. You've got a doomsday cult in control of 200 nuclear weapons, controls the world's economy, controls the world's media, and right now literally has the president of the United States by the you-know-what and is using this latest scandal to blackmail him into launching a war against Syria that will expand to include a war against Iran that will then expand to include a war against Russia.
What would a war between the United States and Russia look like?
I mean, we would like to entertain the idea that saner heads, cooler heads would prevail. But we do have to keep in mind that the United States is the only country to have used nuclear weapons, meaning the two nukes that we dropped on Japan in the waning days of World War II. And I believe that this was done in order to demonstrate to the world, this was Zionism's demonstration to the world, this is what we will do to you. We will loose our most vicious pit people on you if you don't play ball with us. We will drop nuclear weapons on your cities if you don't give us what we want. The problem is that even if the United States does exercise some means of restraint within the context of war with Russia, the problem is that you've got Israeli submarines out there, courtesy of the Germans, very modern, up-to-date submarines that are now loaded with nuclear missiles. This was reported by Der Spiegel, considered one of the most prestigious news sources in Germany. In fact, the news story carrying the announcement that Israel had been outfitted with 6 Dolphin-class submarines by Germany, the subtitle of the article referenced the Samson option, which is Israel's nuclear protocol that if her precious experiment in Jewish self-rule looks as though it's going to go down the tubes, that she is going to unleash her nuclear weapons against the entire world. She's made this clear. She has made this clear in statements from high-level academics and military people that if she goes down, she's going to take the world down with her. So as much as America may exercise some restraint in any type of shooting war with the Russians, that's not to exclude the possibility slash likelihood that Israel, it wouldn't launch nuclear weapons with one of these submarines, make it look like it came from the Russians against the Americans or vice versa. This is what she does well. By way of deception, we shall do war. That's the motto of Israel's Mossad. And also, Dave, what we have to keep in mind here is the entire messianic vision that Israel's founders had then and what they have now, which is that Israel is supposed to be the next world superpower. Now, how does this tiny little sliver of land along the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, how does this country become the next world superpower if it has to compete with countries such as the United States and Russia? Well, simple. You get these two to wipe each other out through a nuclear war, through whatever. And then what's left are the vultures to come and to pick clean the carcasses. And I think that this is exactly what Israel has in mind, is to see a war between the U.S. and Russia take place so that she can then step forward to fill in that vacuum and declare herself the seat of the New World Order.
Oh, that's scary. I want to just ask you about this, Mark, because it seems like whenever there are wars, there are Jews and or Israelis involved in the planning of these wars. It seems like throughout modern history in the United States, there have always been Jewish war advisors to presidents. Is there something unique or specific about Jews that would lead them to favor war over diplomacy?
Of course. And it's not a racial thing, it is pure religion. We have been given a constant lecture by the Jewish mainstream media about how evil and warlike Islam is, the religion of Islam. But as is typically the case, this is an exercise in projection on the part of these organized Jewish interests, because a genocide and jihad, conversion by the sword, all of these things had their start with the religion of the Jews. And I'm just going to read for you a few quotations. And this doesn't come out of the Talmud. And this is, of course, this is where things get a little bit sticky. People don't like to hear things like this coming out of books such as the Bible. But that is indeed where they come from. It's been sitting there as an open secret now for thousands of years that the Jews are a very warlike people by virtue of the very warlike religion that they practice. I just want to read for you a few passages, and these come out of the Bible within the very first chapters of the Old Testament. Quote, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are to possess and casts out the many peoples living there, you shall then slaughter them all and utterly destroy them. You shall make no agreements with them nor show them any mercy. You shall destroy their altars, break down their images, cut down their groves, and burn their graven images with fire, because you are a holy people unto the Lord thy God, and he has chosen you to be a special people above all others upon the face of the earth." Now, this comes out of the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 7, verses 1 through 8. I'll just read a few other passages, if I may. And believe me, Dave, we could sit here till the sun comes up tomorrow morning. I could still be reading passages.
Well, that's okay. I just want to make it clear to the listeners that although this is a tape program, that in no way did you or I speak about what we were going to discuss here, and that me asking you this question, you had no idea that I was going to ask it to you.
No, but Dave, it is absolutely intrinsic to understanding why we find ourselves in the mess that we're in right now. That very passage right there that I read for you, right out of the book of Deuteronomy. And believe me, folks, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of similar passages where the God of the Jews is telling them, look, you see that promised land over there? Go into it and kill everything in it. Leave nothing alive that breathes. That's one of the quotations, I believe, that comes either out of Deuteronomy or Leviticus. Leave nothing alive that breathes. Oh, and the women folk, okay, all of those who have known men carnally, meaning they're not virgins, kill them by the sword. But all of the young girls who have never known man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. Now, I'm not making these things up, okay? This is not fiction, and this isn't the Talmud either. You know, there's far too much concentration paid on the writings of the Talmud when the real blood and guts of Judaism you can find right within the pages of your own Bible. So your original question, Dave, is why is it that Jews utilize war in achieving their ends? Because this is the lifeblood of their religion, is to go in and to cast a covetous eye upon something or someone, and then to utilize violence, even if it means wiping out entire civilizations of people, to utilize what they consider to be holy war in achieving these ends. It may be hard on the ears, it may be hard on the heart, but this is the ugly truth that we're facing here, is that we are dealing with a group of jihadists here, okay, and I'm not talking about the Muslims. We're dealing with a group of religious fanatics here who really do believe that their God wants them to go and to kill, butcher innocent men, women, and children in order to attain their end. And this is the reason why we find ourselves in the mess that we're in right now, not just as Americans fighting these wars in the Middle East, but why our economy is in the shape that it's in, why our culture has been completely flushed down the sewer, down the toilet. This is all the application of warfare. You can drop bombs on people, innocent men, women, and children in places like Gaza and Libya and Syria, or you can just use the radioactive nature of a corrosive and corrupt media programming to destroy the morals of a country. So one is a quick death and the other is a long, drawn-out death, you know, like the death of dying from radiation poisoning. Okay? But it's all the application of Jewish warfare.
And thank you for explaining that, because I've always wondered why it was that where there's war, there's Jews. Do you think that the actual makeup, the physical and biological makeup of a Jew, because obviously they inbreed a lot, and this is well known, there's a variety of genetic diseases that Ashkenazi share. Do you think that has something to do with their mental state?
I am very honored and privileged, Dave, to have friends and people I work very closely with doing what I do, who grew up in that Jewish environment, but who walked away from it. They said, forget it. I don't want to have anything to do with it. People such as Gilad Atzman, Bob Tuscan, who also is a radio host, Brother Nathaniel Kapner, all of these guys grew up Jewish, and at some point in their life, they said, forget it. You know, they had their Saul of Tarsus moment, where Saul was on the road to Damascus. And Saul, of course, was the biggest persecutor of the Christians in the New Testament after Jesus died. It was his job to hunt them down and to kill them. And he had, at least as the story goes, he had this vision on his way to Damascus where Jesus appeared to him and he said, Saul, why do you persecute me? And Saul was a changed man after this. And instead of becoming a persecutor of the Christians, he became a defender of Christians. And so you do see these things happening where the pit bull decides to become a vegetarian. He decides he's not going to eat the neighborhood cats anymore, and he's not going to attack the kids in the neighborhood. He's just going to live peaceably with people. Now, that doesn't happen very often. So as far as it being a genetic thing, I know that there are people who argue that, but I don't. I think that it is purely a result of environment. I think it's a result of how they have been bred and how they have been reared and what they have been taught. And I think that they do have a choice. They can choose to not be like this. All they have to do is say, hey, forget it. These people that I have associated around myself, they're always getting me into some kind of trouble, and I don't want to have anything to do with them. I would rather get along with my Gentile neighbors over here to my right and my Gentile neighbors over here to my left. Now, that's not to say that it's as simple as that, because the power that the rabbis have over the Jewish community is something that I think, I mean, if we really want to get into some esoteric things, I think that Judaism is a diabolical ideology. I think that it is empowered by forces that are much stronger than what we can understand with our simple eyes and ears. And I think that the sway that the rabbis have over these people is absolutely diabolical, and it's a very difficult spell to break. part of the proof that I use for this is the fact that you mentioned the word the Ashkenazi. Now, anybody who has been studying this issue knows that a good portion, and by that we mean 90%+ of those today calling themselves Jews, that they have no racial connection with Middle Easterners or people from the Middle East, like, say, for example, those who lived during the time of Jesus. Okay, so what do we have in common with these people if there's nothing racially that connects them? Well, it's the ideology. It's that same poisonous doctrine that they grew up in a crime-ridden neighborhood. And it doesn't matter what kind of person's up in that crime-ridden neighborhood. Chances are you're going to come out of it a criminal. You can be white, you can be black, you can be Latino, you can be Chinese, Oriental, whatever. If you grow up in an environment of crime, then you're more than likely, the chances are you're going to grow up and become a criminal. So as far as it being a racially driven thing, it's very simple for me. What race are they? You have Jews who are black. You have Jews who are Middle Eastern. You have Jews who are European. You have Jews who are from Latin America. There was even a tribe of Jews out of India recently who made Aliyah back to Israel. And they're considered Jews, even though there's nothing racially that connects them with these people. They're no more a race, in my opinion, than Catholics are a race, or Baptists are a race, or Methodists are a race, or even atheists for that matter. It's just a matter of ideology. And once this ideology has been defeated, that is my goal, is eradication through education. Once Judaism has been exposed as really the gutter religion and the diabolical ideology that it is, and it's no longer considered to be up there with the world's quote-unquote great religions, once people understand that, then we have made the first step in a very important journey in liberating ourselves from the power of these people. Because up to this point, what has given them the pass in society to allow them to accumulate the kinds of power and influence that they have is that, A, of course, everyone has bought into the notion that they are a persecuted class of people who pose no threat to society. That's A, which is completely false. And B, that they follow a religion that is considered one of the world's great religions. I say no. Judaism needs to be cast into the fire where it belongs, just as Jesus Christ said. It needs to be buried in the ash heap of history, along with people who used to believe that the earth was flat and that the sun revolved around the earth and not vice versa. We can do this. We just need to apply the rules of logic and enlightenment and to enlighten and liberate these people themselves, because until the Jews themselves are freed from this poisonous ideology, the rest of the world is going to be enslaved to it as well.
Well, I was going to ask you that about what we could do about it. I mean, I guess for listeners who haven't been exposed to this information the way that you have, the way that a few people have, not very many, as we were talking about before the broadcast a couple of hours ago, what should they do? Where's the first place they should go? Can they come to your website and learn what they need to learn in order to become a viable force against?
I'm not going to be arrogant enough to consider myself to be a major cog in the wheel, Dave. I think that I play a relatively small part in all of this. I think that we're early in the process here. I consider what I do and what you do and people like Mike Piper and all of the rest of us who are part of this movement to rid the world of this contagion, this terrible virus that is destroying everything that it touches. You know, I consider us to be similar to those just coming out of the Dark Ages and into what we would call the Enlightenment. People who were saying, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to bleed people to heal them of their diseases. Maybe the earth isn't flat. Maybe we need to revisit this. Maybe these things that we have held to in the past, maybe they're antiquated, they're out of date, and they need to be replaced with new ideas. Now, for me, what I see as absolutely intrinsic to this is that Judaism has to be declared for what it is, which is a form of mental illness. And I don't mean just Judaism in 2013 AD, but Judaism in 2013 BC. And what I mean by that, Dave, is that Judaism always is what it is now. If the patriarchs of the Old Testament, the same ones who were talking about, go into this town and kill all these people and go into that village and slaughter all those people, if they had had the same mechanisms at their disposal, the media, control of money, and the military, if they had had those means at their disposal 4,000 years ago, they would have utilized them just like their great-great-great-great-grandchildren are utilizing them today. So I think that this is the first step that has to be taken in healing ourselves of this terrible sickness that we have, is in declaring that Judaism has been, from the very beginning, there was never a moment where it was anything other than a toxic force upon mankind. It's always been radioactive element. It's always been deadly poison to any life that was in its environment. Always, from the very beginning. From the beginning, when this penniless nomad known as Abraham is wandering around the desert, hearing voices in his head telling him that he is better than everyone else and that he and his descendants are destined to rule the world. And that's in the first book of the Bible, Dave. So that is the first step that has to happen, is that we have to throw out all of these old, antiquated, backwards ideas about what Judaism is and what it was, and what, more importantly, what it never was. It was never a positive force for good for mankind. No matter where you go in history, wherever it has gone, it has produced nothing but criminality and exploitation and suffering for those who find themselves on the receiving end of it.
Now, you've been doing this for a while, Mark. What do you think the odds are that this is going to be done in our lifetimes?
Well, Dave, as corny as it sounds, I believe in miracles, and I do. Look, every day of my life is a miracle. I wake up, I look around, and I look at this beautiful woman who married me, who, if she had been in her right mind, she would never have done it, who has given me 9 children. I'm blessed to have all of these good things around me. Everything around me is a miracle. So I know miracles exist. Just this past Sunday in Mass, we read the story of when Jesus fed the 5,000. And those who have had some type of Sunday school rearing will remember that what is taking place is Jesus is preaching to the crowd for 3 days. And he dismisses them to go back to their homes. But he says, we can't let these people go back to their homes because they've been here for 3 days with nothing to eat. And some of them have come from a very long distance. And if we let them go now, they're going to fall along the way, meaning they're going to pass out or whatever. And so he says, what do we have here? And so they bring to him a few loaves of bread and some fishes. Call it myth, call it allegory, whatever you want to call it. The point of the story here is, if we believe that this happened, and I happen to believe that it did, that Jesus takes his meager offering, and through some kind of power that he has, he multiplies this to feed 5,000 people. Now, if we apply this to what we ourselves are doing today, Dave, and, you know, since we are on the eve of our own independence, our birthday as a nation, that in and of itself was something of a miracle, too, because there should have been no way that we would have won this contest with the British.
Right, that's true.
Okay, that we shouldn't have. And it was only because there was a series of blunders on some individual's behalf and a series of inexplicable events on others that led to this thing taking place, for better or for worse. I believe that if we just keep plodding along and we just keep doing what we're doing, and we look at this thing as a marathon race, it's not a sprint. People like you and I and our good friend Mike Piper and others, it's not our job to win the race. Our job is to run from point A to point B, and at point B, we hand the baton off to the next guy. And then he runs it from point B to point C, and at point C, he hands it off to the next guy. So we do our part, we hand off the baton, we hope that the other guys are going to run their rear ends off the way that we did, and we hope that somehow, if you want to call it fate or a miracle or just plain dumb luck, that we're going to win, and I do believe that we're going to win. Whether we live to see it or not is immaterial. The point is that we've got a race to run, and that's what we've got to do.
That's great. Mark, we never had the pleasure of speaking to one another. I never had the pleasure of having you on my show. I'm glad that we were able to hook up because it was thoroughly enjoyable for me. And I'm sure it was for the listeners. And I want to thank you so much for the analysis of this event and others, and looking forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Anytime, Dave. I am your humble servant.